spoke out against the war and the draft, and the House voted that he not be seated because his statements violated the Selective Service Act and tend to bring discredit to the House. The Supreme Court restored Bond to his seat, saying he had the right to free expression under the First Amendment. One of the great sports figures of the nation, Muhammad Ali, the black boxer and heavyweight champion, refused to serve in what he called a white man's war. Boxing authorities took away his title as champion. Martin Luther King Jr. spoke out in 1967 at Riverside Church in New York. "Somehow this madness must cease. We must stop now. I speak as a child of God and brother to the suffering poor of Vietnam. I speak for those whose land is being laid waste, whose homes are being destroyed, whose culture is being subverted. I speak for the poor of America who are paying the double price of smashed hopes at home and death and corruption in Vietnam. I speak as a citizen of the world, for the world as it stands aghast at the path we have taken. I speak as an American to the leaders of my own nation. The great initiative in this war is ours. The initiative to stop it must be ours." Young men began to refuse to register for the draft, refuse to be inducted if called. As early as May 1964, the slogan, "We won't go," was widely publicized. Some who had registered began publicly burning their draft cards to protest the war. One, David O'Brien, burned his draft card in South Boston. He was convicted, and the Supreme Court overruled his argument that this was a protected form of free expression. In October of 1967, there were organized draft card turn-ins all over the country. In San Francisco alone, 300 draft cards were returned to the government. Just before a huge demonstration at the Pentagon that month, a sack of collected draft cards was presented to the Justice Department. By mid-1965, 380 prosecutions were begun against men refusing to be inducted. By mid-1968, that figure was up to 3,305. At the end of 1969, there were 33,960 delinquents nationwide. In May 1969, the Oakland Induction Center, where draftees reported from all of Northern California, reported that of 4,400 men ordered to report for induction, 2,400 did not show up. In the first quarter of 1970, the selective service system, for the first time, could not meet its quota. A Boston University graduate student in history, Philip Supina, wrote on May 1, 1968, to his draft board in Tucson, Arizona, "I am enclosing the order for me to report for my pre-induction physical exam for the armed forces. I have absolutely no intention to report for that exam, or for induction, or to aid in any way the American war effort against the people of Vietnam." He ended his letter by quoting the Spanish philosopher Miguel Unamuno, who during the Spanish Civil War said, "Sometimes to be silent is to lie." Supina was convicted and sentenced to 4 years in prison. Early in the war, there had been two separate incidents barely noticed by most Americans. On November 2, 1965, in front of the Pentagon in Washington, as thousands of employees were streaming out of the building in the late afternoon, Norman Morrison, a 32-year-old pacifist, father of three, stood below the third-floor windows of Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara, doused himself with kerosene, and set himself afire, giving up his life in protest against the war. Also that year in Detroit, an 82-year-old woman named Alice Hertz burned herself to death to make a statement against the horror of Indochina. A remarkable change in sentiment took place. In early 1965, when the bombing of North Vietnam began, 100 people gathered on the Boston Common to voice their indignation. On October 15, 1969, the number of people assembled on the Boston Common to protest the war was 100,000. Perhaps 2 million people across the nation gathered that day in towns and villages that had never seen an anti-war meeting. In the summer of 1965, a few hundred people had gathered in Washington to march in protest against the war. The first in line, historian Staunton Lind, SNCC organizer Bob Moses, and longtime pacifist David Dellinger, were splattered with red paint by hecklers. But by 1970, the Washington peace rallies were drawing hundreds of thousands of people. In 1971, 20,000 came to Washington to commit civil disobedience, trying to tie up Washington traffic to express their revulsion against the killing still going on in Vietnam. 14,000 of them were arrested, the largest mass arrest in American history. Hundreds of volunteers in the Peace Corps spoke out against the war. In Chile, 92 volunteers defied the Peace Corps director and issued a circular denouncing the war. 800 former members of the Corps issued a statement of protest against what was happening in Vietnam. The poet Robert Lowell, invited to a White House function, refused to come. Arthur Miller, also invited, sent a telegram to the White House. "When the guns boom, the arts die." Singer Eartha Kitt was invited to a luncheon on the White House lawn and shocked all those present by speaking out in the presence of the president's wife against the war. A teenager called to the White House to accept a prize came and criticized the war. In Hollywood, local artists erected a 60-foot tower of protest on Sunset Boulevard. At the National Book Award ceremonies in New York, 50 authors and publishers walked out on a speech by Vice President Humphrey in a display of anger at his role in the war. In London, two young Americans gatecrashed the American ambassador's elegant 4th of July reception and called out a toast, "To all the dead and dying in Vietnam." They were carried out by guards. In the Pacific Ocean, two young American seamen hijacked an American munitions ship to divert its load of bombs from air bases in Thailand. For 4 days, they took command of the ship and its crew, taking amphetamine pills to stay awake, until the ship reached Cambodian waters. The Associated Press reported in late 1972 from York, Pennsylvania, "Five anti-war activists were arrested by the state police today for allegedly sabotaging railroad equipment near a factory that makes bomb casings used in the Vietnam War." Middle-class and professional people, unaccustomed to activism, began to speak up. In May 1970, the New York Times reported from Washington, 1,000 establishment lawyers join war protest. Corporations began to wonder whether the war was going to hurt their long-range business interests. The Wall Street Journal began criticizing the continuation of the war. As the war became more and more unpopular, people in or close to the government began to break out of the circle of assent. The most dramatic instance was the case of Daniel Ellsberg. Ellsberg was a Harvard-trained economist, a former Marine officer employed by the RAND Corporation, which did special, often secret research for the U.S. government. Ellsberg helped write the Department of Defense history of the war in Vietnam, and then decided to make the top-secret document public with the aid of his friend Anthony Russo, a former RAND Corporation man. The two had met in Saigon, where both had been affected in different experiences by direct sight of the war, and had become powerfully indignant at what the United States was doing to the people of Vietnam. Ellsberg and Russo spent night after night, after hours, at a friend's advertising agency, duplicating the 7,000-page document. Then Ellsberg gave copies to various congressmen and to the New York Times. In June 1971, the Times began printing selections from what came to be known as the Pentagon Papers. It created a national sensation. The Nixon administration tried to get the Supreme Court to stop further publication, but the court said that this was prior restraint of the freedom of the press and thus unconstitutional. The government then indicted Ellsberg and Russo for violating the Espionage Act by releasing classified documents to unauthorized people. They faced long terms in prison if convicted. The judge, however, called off the trial during the jury deliberations because the Watergate events unfolding at the time revealed unfair practices by the prosecution. Ellsberg, by his bold act, had broken with the usual tactic of dissidents inside the government who bided their time and kept their opinions to themselves, hoping for small changes in policy. A colleague urged him not to leave the government because there he had access, saying, "Don't cut yourself off. Don't cut your throat." Ellsberg replied, "Life exists outside the executive branch." The anti-war movement, early in its growth, found a strange new constituency, priests and nuns of the Catholic Church. Some of them had been aroused by the civil rights movement, others by their experiences in Latin America, where they saw poverty and injustice under governments supported by the United States. In the fall of 1967, Father Philip Berrigan, a Josephite priest who was a veteran of World War II, joined by artists Tom Lewis and friends David Eberhardt and James Mengel, went to the office of a draft board in Baltimore, Maryland, drenched the draft records with blood, and waited to be arrested. They were put on trial and sentenced to prison terms of 2 to 6 years. The following May, Philip Berrigan, out on bail in the Baltimore case, was joined in a second action by his brother Daniel, a Jesuit priest who had visited North Vietnam and seen the effects of U.S. bombing. They and 7 other people went into a draft board office in Catonsville, Maryland, removed records, and set them afire outside in the presence of reporters and onlookers. They were convicted and sentenced to prison and became famous as the Catonsville Nine. Dan Berrigan wrote a meditation at the time of the Catonsville incident. "Our apologies, good friends, for the fracture of good order, the burning of paper instead of children, the angering of the orderlies in the front parlor of the charnel house. We could not, so help us God, do otherwise. We say, killing is disorder. Life and gentleness and community and unselfishness is the only order we recognize. For the sake of that order, we risk our liberty, our good name. The time is past when good men can remain silent, when obedience can segregate men from public risk, when the poor can die without defense." When his appeals had been exhausted and he was supposed to go to prison, Daniel Berrigan disappeared. While the FBI searched for him, he showed up at an Easter festival at Cornell University, where he had been teaching. With dozens of FBI men looking for him in the crowd, he suddenly appeared on stage. Then the lights went out. He hid inside a giant figure of the Bread and Puppet Theater, which was on stage, was carried out to a truck, and escaped to a nearby farmhouse. He stayed underground for 4 months, writing poems, issuing statements, giving secret interviews, appearing suddenly in a Philadelphia church to give a sermon, and then disappearing again, baffling the FBI, until an informer's interception of a letter disclosed his whereabouts and he was captured and imprisoned. The one woman among the Catonsville Nine, Mary Moylan, a former nun, also refused to surrender to the FBI. She was never found. Writing from underground, she reflected on her experience and how she came to it. "We had all known we were going to jail, so we all had our toothbrushes. I was just exhausted. I took my little box of clothes and stuck it under the cot and climbed into bed. Now, all the women in the Baltimore County jail were black. I think there was only one white. The women were waking me up and saying, 'Aren't you going to cry?' I said, 'What about?' They said, 'You're in jail.' And I said, 'Yeah, I knew I'd be here.' I was sleeping between 2 of these women, and every morning I'd wake up, and they'd be leaning on their elbows watching me. They'd say, 'You slept all night,' and they couldn't believe it. They were good. We had a good time." I suppose the political turning point in my life came while I was in Uganda. I was there when American planes were bombing the Congo, and we were very close to the Congo border. The planes came over and bombed two villages in Uganda. Where the hell did the American planes come in? Later I was in Dar es Salaam, and Chou En Lai came to town. The American embassy sent out letters saying that no Americans were to be on the street because this was a dirty communist leader. But I decided this was a man who was making history, and I wanted to see him. When I came home from Africa, I moved to Washington and had to deal with the scene there and the insanity and brutality of the cops and the type of life that was led by most of the citizens of that city, 70% black. And then Vietnam and the napalm and the defoliants and the bombings. I got involved with the women's movement about a year ago. At the time of Catonsville, going to jail made sense to me, partially because of the black scene. So many blacks forever filling the jails. I don't think it's a valid tactic anymore. I don't want to see people marching off to jail with smiles on their faces. I just don't want them going. The 70s are going to be very difficult, and I don't want to waste the sisters and brothers we have by marching them off to jail and having mystical experiences or whatever they're going to have. The effect of the war and of the bold action of some priests and nuns was to crack the traditional conservatism of the Catholic community. On Moratorium Day 1969, at the Newton College of the Sacred Heart near Boston, a sanctuary of bucolic quiet and political silence, the great front door of the college displayed a huge painted red fist. At Boston College, a Catholic institution, 6,000 people gathered that evening in the gymnasium to denounce the war. Students were heavily involved in the early protests against the war. A survey by the Urban Research Corporation for the first 6 months of 1969 only, and for only 232 of the nation's 2,000 institutions of higher education, showed that at least 215,000 students had participated in campus protests, that 3,652 had been arrested, that 956 had been suspended or expelled. Even in the high schools in the late 60s, there were 500 underground newspapers. At the Brown University commencement in 1969, two-thirds of the graduating class turned their backs when Henry Kissinger stood up to address them. The climax of protest came in the spring of 1970, when President Nixon ordered the invasion of Cambodia. At Kent State University in Ohio, on May 4th, when students gathered to demonstrate against the war, National Guardsmen fired into the crowd. Four students were killed. One was paralyzed for life. Students at 400 colleges and universities went on strike in protest. It was the first general student strike in the history of the United States. During that school year of 1969 to 1970, the FBI listed 1,785 student demonstrations, including the occupation of 313 buildings. The commencement day ceremonies after the Kent State killings were unlike any the nation had ever seen. From Amherst, Massachusetts, came this newspaper report. The 100th commencement of the University of Massachusetts yesterday was a protest, a call for peace. The roll of the funeral drum set the beat for 2,600 young men and women marching, in fear, in despair, and in frustration. Red fists of protest, white peace symbols, and blue doves were stenciled on black academic gowns, and nearly every other senior wore an armband representing a plea for peace. Student protests against the ROTC, Reserve Officers Training Program, resulted in the canceling of those programs in over 40 colleges and universities. In 1966, 191,749 college students enrolled in ROTC. By 1973, the number was 72,459. The ROTC was depended on to supply half the officers in Vietnam. In September 1973, for the sixth straight month, the ROTC could not fulfill its quota. One Army official said, "I just hope we don't get into another war, because if we do, I doubt we could fight it." The publicity given to the student protests created the impression that the opposition to the war came mostly from middle-class intellectuals. When some construction workers in New York attacked student demonstrators, the news was played up in the national media. However, a number of elections in American cities, including those where mostly blue-collar workers lived, showed that anti-war sentiment was strong in the working classes. For instance, in Dearborn, Michigan, an automobile manufacturing town, a poll as early as 1967 showed 41% of the population favored withdrawal from the Vietnam War. In 1970, in two counties in California where petitioners placed the issue on the ballot, San Francisco County and Marin County, referenda asking withdrawal of the U.S. forces from Vietnam received a majority vote. In late 1970, when a Gallup poll presented the statement, "The United States should withdraw all troops from Vietnam by the end of next year," 65% of those questioned said yes. In Madison, Wisconsin, in the spring of 1971, a resolution calling for an immediate withdrawal of U.S. forces from Southeast Asia won by 31,000 to 16,000. In 1968, such a resolution had lost. But the most surprising data were in a survey made by the University of Michigan. This showed that throughout the Vietnam War, Americans with only a grade school education were much stronger for withdrawal from the war than Americans with a college education. In June 1966, of people with a college education, 27% were for immediate withdrawal from Vietnam. Of people with only a grade school education, 41% were for immediate withdrawal. By September 1970, both groups were more anti-war. 47% of the college-educated were for withdrawal, and 61% of grade school graduates. There is more evidence of the same kind. In an article in American Sociological Review, June 1968, Richard F. Hamilton found in his survey of public opinion, "Preferences for tough policy alternatives are most frequent among the following groups: the highly educated, high-status occupations, those with high incomes, younger persons, and those paying much attention to newspapers and magazines." And a political scientist, Harlan Hahn, doing a study of various city referenda on Vietnam, found support for withdrawal from Vietnam highest in groups of lower socioeconomic status. He also found that the regular polls, based on samplings, underestimated the opposition to the war among lower-class people. All this was part of a general change in the entire population of the country. In August of 1965, 61% of the population thought the American involvement in Vietnam was not wrong. By May 1971, it was exactly reversed. 61% thought our involvement was wrong. Bruce Andrews, a Harvard student of public opinion, found that the people most opposed to the war were people over 50, blacks and women. He also noted that a study in the spring of 1964, when Vietnam was a minor issue in the newspapers, showed that 53% of college-educated people were willing to send troops to Vietnam, but only 33% of grade school-educated people were so willing. It seems that the media, themselves controlled by higher education, higher income people who were more aggressive in foreign policy, tended to give the erroneous impression that working class people were super patriots for the war. Louis Leipsitz, in a mid-1968 survey of poor blacks and whites in the South, paraphrased an attitude he found typical. "The only way to help the poor man is to get out of that war in Vietnam. These taxes, high taxes, it's going over yonder to kill people with, and I don't see no cause in it." The capacity for independent judgment among ordinary Americans is probably best shown by the swift development of anti-war feeling among American GIs, volunteers and draftees, who came mostly from lower-income groups. There had been earlier in American history instances of soldiers' disaffection from the war, isolated mutinies in the Revolutionary War, refusal of reenlistment in the midst of hostilities in the Mexican War, desertion and conscientious objection in World War I and World War II. But Vietnam produced opposition by soldiers and veterans on a scale and with a fervor never seen before. It began with isolated protests. As early as June 1965, Richard Steinke, a West Point graduate in Vietnam, refused to board an aircraft taking him to a remote Vietnamese village. "The Vietnamese War," he said, "is not worth a single American life." Steinke was court-martialed and dismissed from the service. The following year, three Army privates, one black, one Puerto Rican, one Lithuanian-Italian, all poor, refused to embark for Vietnam, denouncing the war as immoral, illegal, and unjust. They were court-martialed and imprisoned. In early 1967, Captain Howard Levy, an Army doctor at Fort Jackson, South Carolina, refused to teach Green Berets, a special forces elite in the military. He said they were murderers of women and children and killers of peasants. He was court-martialed on the grounds that he was trying to promote disaffection among enlisted men by his statements. The colonel who presided at the trial said, "The truth of the statements is not an issue in this case." Levy was convicted and sentenced to prison. The individual acts multiplied. A black private in Oakland refused to board a troop plane to Vietnam, although he faced 11 years at hard labor. A Navy nurse, Lieutenant Susan Schnall, was court-martialed for marching in a peace demonstration while in uniform and for dropping anti-war leaflets from a plane on Navy installations. In Norfolk, Virginia, a sailor refused to train fighter pilots because he said the war was immoral. An Army lieutenant was arrested in Washington, D.C. in early 1968 for picketing the White House with a sign that said, "120,000 American casualties, why?" Two black Marines, George Daniels and William Harvey, were given long prison sentences, Daniels 6 years, Harvey 10 years, both later reduced, for talking to other black Marines against the war. As the war went on, desertions from the armed forces mounted. Thousands went to Western Europe, France, Sweden, Holland. Most deserters crossed into Canada. Some estimates were 50,000, others 100,000. Some stayed in the United States. A few openly defied the military authorities by taking sanctuary in churches, where, surrounded by anti-war friends and sympathizers, they waited for capture and court-martial. At Boston University, 1,000 students kept vigil for 5 days and nights in the chapel, supporting an 18-year-old deserter, Ray Kroll. Kroll's story was a common one. He had been inveigled into joining the army. He came from a poor family, was brought into court, charged with drunkenness, and given the choice of prison or enlistment. He enlisted. And then he began to think about the nature of the war. On a Sunday morning, federal agents showed up at the Boston University chapel, stomped their way through aisles clogged with students, smashed down doors, and took Kroll away. From the stockade, he wrote back to friends, "I ain't gonna kill. It's against my will." A friend he had made at the chapel brought him books, and he noted saying he had found in one of them, "What we have done will not be lost to all eternity. Everything ripens at its time and becomes fruit at its hour." The GI anti-war movement became more organized. Near Fort Jackson, South Carolina, the first GI coffee house was set up, a place where soldiers could get coffee and donuts, find anti-war literature, and talk freely with others. It was called the UFO and lasted for several years before it was declared a public nuisance and closed by court action. but other GI coffee houses sprang up in half a dozen other places across the country. An anti-war bookstore was opened near Fort Devens, Massachusetts, and another one at the Newport, Rhode Island Naval Base. Underground newspapers sprang up at military bases across the country. By 1970, more than 50 were circulating. Among them, About Face in Los Angeles, Fed Up in Tacoma, Washington, Short Times at Fort Jackson, Vietnam GI in Chicago, Graffiti in Heidelberg, Germany, Bragg Briefs in North Carolina, Last Harass at Fort Gordon, Georgia, Helping Hand at Mountain Home Air Base, Idaho. These newspapers printed anti-war articles, gave news about the harassment of GIs and practical advice on the legal rights of servicemen, told how to resist military domination. Mixed with feeling against the war was resentment at the cruelty, the dehumanization of military life. In the army prisons, the stockades, this was especially true. In 1968, at the Presidio Stockade in California, a guard shot to death an emotionally disturbed prisoner for walking away from a work detail. 27 prisoners then sat down and refused to work, singing, "We Shall Overcome." They were court-martialed, found guilty of mutiny, and sentenced to terms of up to 14 years, later reduced after much public attention and protest. The dissidents spread to the war front itself. When the great Moratorium Day demonstrations were taking place in October 1969 in the United States, some GIs in Vietnam wore black armbands to show their support. A news photographer reported that in a platoon on patrol near Da Nang, about half of the men were wearing black armbands. One soldier stationed at Cu Chi wrote to a friend on October 26, 1970, that separate companies had been set up for men refusing to go into the field to fight. "It's no big thing here anymore to refuse to go." The French newspaper Le Monde reported that in 4 months, 109 soldiers of the 1st Air Cavalry Division were charged with refusal to fight. "A common sight," the correspondent for Le Monde wrote, "is the black soldier with his left fist clenched in defiance of a war he has never considered his own." Wallace Terry, a black American reporter for Time magazine, taped conversations with hundreds of black soldiers. He found bitterness against army racism, disgust with the war, generally low morale. More and more cases of fragging were reported in Vietnam, incidents where servicemen rolled fragmentation bombs under the tents of officers who were ordering them into combat, or against whom they had other grievances. The Pentagon reported 209 fraggings in Vietnam in 1970 alone. Veterans back from Vietnam formed a group called Vietnam Veterans Against the War. In December 1970, hundreds of them went to Detroit to what was called the Winter Soldier Investigations to testify publicly about atrocities they had participated in or seen in Vietnam committed by Americans against Vietnamese. In April 1971, more than 1,000 of them went to Washington, D.C. to demonstrate against the war. One by one, they went up to a wire fence around the Capitol, threw over the fence the medals they had won in Vietnam, and made brief statements about the war, sometimes emotionally, sometimes in icy, bitter calm. In the summer of 1970, 28 commissioned officers of the military, including some veterans of Vietnam, saying they represented about 250 other officers, announced formation of the Concerned Officers Movement Against the War. During the fierce bombings of Hanoi and Haiphong around Christmas 1972, came the first defiance of B-52 pilots who refused to fly those missions. On June 3, 1973, the New York Times reported dropouts among West Point cadets. Officials there, the reporter wrote, linked the rate to an affluent, less disciplined, skeptical, and questioning generation and to the anti-military mood that a small radical minority in the Vietnam War had created. But most of the anti-war action came from ordinary GIs, and most of these came from lower-income groups, white, black, Native American, Chinese, and Chicano. Chicanos back home were demonstrating by the thousands against the war. A 20-year-old New York City Chinese American named Sam Choi, enlisted at 17 in the Army, was sent to Vietnam, was made a cook, and found himself the target of abuse by fellow GIs who called him chink and gook, the term for the Vietnamese, and said he looked like the enemy. One day he took a rifle and fired warning shots at his tormentors. By this time I was near the perimeter of the base and was thinking of joining the Viet Cong. At least they would trust me. Choi was taken by military police, beaten, court-martialed, sentenced to 18 months of hard labor at Fort Leavenworth. They beat me up every day like a time clock. He ended his interview with a New York Chinatown newspaper saying, "One thing, I want to tell all the Chinese kids that the army made me sick. They made me so sick that I can't stand it." A dispatch from Phu Bai in April 1972 said that 50 GIs out of 142 men in the company refused to go on patrol, crying, "This isn't our war." The New York Times on July 14, 1973, reported that American prisoners of war in Vietnam, ordered by officers in the POW camp to stop cooperating with the enemy, shouted back, "Who's the enemy?" They formed a peace committee in the camp, and a sergeant on the committee later recalled his march from capture to the POW camp. "Until we got to the first camp, we didn't see a village intact. They were all destroyed. I sat down and put myself in the middle and asked myself, is this right or wrong? Is it right to destroy villages? Is it right to kill people en masse? After a while, it just got to me." Pentagon officials in Washington and Navy spokesmen in San Diego announced after the United States withdrew its troops from Vietnam in 1973 that the Navy was going to purge itself of undesirables, and that these included as many as 6,000 men in the Pacific Fleet, a substantial proportion of them black. Altogether, about 700,000 GIs had received less than honorable discharges. In the year 1973, one of every five discharges was less than honorable, indicating something less than dutiful obedience to the military. By 1971, 177 of every 1,000 American soldiers were listed as absent without leave, some of them three or four times. Deserters doubled from 47,000 in 1967 to 89,000 in 1971. One of those who stayed, fought, but then turned against the war was Ron Kovic. His father worked in a supermarket on Long Island. In 1963, at the age of 17, he enlisted in the Marines. 2 years later, in Vietnam, at the age of 19, his spine was shattered by shellfire. Paralyzed from the waist down, he was put in a wheelchair. Back in the States, he observed the brutal treatment of wounded veterans in the veterans' hospitals, thought more and more about the war, and joined the Vietnam Veterans Against the War. He went to demonstrations to speak against the war. One evening, he heard actor Donald Sutherland read from the post-World War I novel by Dalton Trumbo, Johnny Got His Gun, about a soldier whose limbs and face were shot away by gunfire, a thinking torso who invented a way of communicating with the outside world and then beat out a message so powerful it could not be heard without trembling. Sutherland began to read the passage, and something I will never forget swept over me. It was as if someone was speaking for everything I ever went through in the hospital. I began to shake, and I remember there were tears in my eyes. Kovic demonstrated against the war and was arrested. He tells his story in Born on the 4th of July. "They helped me back into the chair and take me to another part of the prison building to be booked. 'What's your name?' the officer behind the desk says. 'Ron Kovic,' I say. 'Occupation, Vietnam veteran against the war.' 'What?' he says sarcastically, looking down at me. I am a Vietnam veteran against the war, I almost shout back. You should have died over there, he says. He turns to his assistant. I'd like to take this guy out and throw him off the roof. They fingerprint me and take my picture and put me in a cell. I have begun to wet my pants like a little baby. The tube has slipped out during my examination by the doctor. I try to fall asleep, but even though I am exhausted, the anger is alive in me like a huge hot stone in my chest. I lean my head up against the wall and listen to the toilets flush again and again. Kovic and the other veterans drove to Miami to the Republican National Convention in 1972, went into the convention hall, wheeled themselves down the aisles, and as Nixon began his acceptance speech, shouted, "Stop the bombing! Stop the war!" Delegates cursed them. Traitor! And Secret Service men hustled them out of the hall. In the fall of 1973, with no victory in sight and North Vietnamese troops entrenched in various parts of the South, the United States agreed to accept a settlement that would withdraw American troops and leave the revolutionary troops where they were until a new elected government would be set up, including communist and non-communist elements. But the Saigon government refused to agree, and the United States decided to make one final attempt to bludgeon the North Vietnamese into submission. It sent waves of B-52s over Hanoi and Haiphong, destroying homes and hospitals, killing unknown numbers of civilians. The attack did not work. Many of the B-52s were shot down. There was angry protest all over the world, and Kissinger went back to Paris and signed very much the same peace agreement that had been agreed on before. The United States withdrew its forces, continuing to give aid to the Saigon government. But when the North Vietnamese launched attacks in early 1975 against the major cities in South Vietnam, the government collapsed. In late April 1975, North Vietnamese troops entered Saigon. The American embassy staff fled, along with many Vietnamese who feared communist rule, and the long war in Vietnam was over. Saigon was renamed Ho Chi Minh City, and both parts of Vietnam were unified as the Democratic Republic of Vietnam. Traditional history portrays the end of wars as coming with the initiatives of leaders, negotiations in Paris or Brussels or Geneva or Versailles, just as it often finds the coming of war a response to the demand of the people. The Vietnam War gave clear evidence that at least for that war, making one wonder about the others, the political leaders were the last to take steps to end the war. The people were far ahead. The president was always far behind. The Supreme Court silently turned away from cases challenging the constitutionality of the war. Congress was years behind public opinion. In the spring of 1971, syndicated columnists Roland Evans and Robert Novak, two firm supporters of the war, wrote regretfully of a sudden outbreak of anti-war emotionalism in the House of Representatives and said, "The anti-war animosities, now suddenly so pervasive among House Democrats, are viewed by administration backers as less anti-Nixon than as a response to constituent pressures." It was only after the intervention in Cambodia ended, and only after the nationwide campus uproar over that invasion, that Congress passed a resolution declaring that American troops should not be sent into Cambodia without its approval. And it was not until late 1973, when American troops had finally been removed from Vietnam, that Congress passed a bill limiting the power of the president to make war without congressional consent. Even there, in that War Powers Resolution, the president could make war for 60 days on his own without a congressional declaration. The administration tried to persuade the American people that the war was ending because of its decision to negotiate a peace, not because it was losing the war, not because of the powerful anti-war movement in the United States. But the government's own secret memoranda all through the war testify to its sensitivity at each stage about public opinion in the United States and abroad. The data is in the Pentagon Papers. In June of 1964, top American military and State Department officials, including Ambassador Henry Cabot Lodge, met in Honolulu. Rusk stated that public opinion on our SEA policy was badly divided and that, therefore, the president needed an affirmation of support. Diem had been replaced by a general named Khan. The Pentagon historians write, upon his return to Saigon on June 5th, Ambassador Lodge went straight from the airport to call on General Khan. The main thrust of his talk with Khan was to hint that the United States government would, in the immediate future, be preparing U.S. public opinion for actions against North Vietnam. 2 months later came the Gulf of Tonkin affair. On April 2, 1965, a memo from CIA Director John McCone suggested that the bombing of North Vietnam be increased because it was not sufficiently severe to change North Vietnam's policy. On the other hand, we can expect increasing pressure to stop the bombing from various elements of the American public, from the press, the United Nations, and world opinion. The U.S. should try for a fast knockout before this opinion could build up, McCone said. Assistant Secretary of Defense John McNaughton's memo of early 1966 suggested destruction of locks and dams to create mass starvation because strikes at population targets would create a counterproductive wave of revulsion abroad and at home. In May 1967, the Pentagon historians write, McNaughton was also very deeply concerned about the breadth and intensity of public unrest and dissatisfaction with the war, especially with young people, the underprivileged, the intelligentsia, and the women. McNaughton worried, will the move to call up 20,000 reserves polarize opinion to the extent that the doves in the United States will get out of hand, massive refusals to serve, or to fight, or to cooperate, or worse? He warned, there may be a limit beyond which many Americans and much of the world will not permit the United States to go. The picture of the world's greatest superpower killing or seriously injuring 1,000 non-combatants a week while trying to pound a tiny backward nation into submission on an issue whose merits are hotly disputed is not a pretty one. It could conceivably produce a costly distortion in the American national consciousness. That costly distortion seems to have taken place by the spring of 1968, when, with the sudden and scary Tet Offensive of the National Liberation Front, Westmoreland asked President Johnson to send him 200,000 more troops on top of the 525,000 already there. Johnson asked a small group of action officers in the Pentagon to advise him on this. They studied the situation and concluded that 200,000 troops would totally Americanize the war and would not strengthen the Saigon government because the Saigon leadership shows no signs of a willingness, let alone an ability, to attract the necessary loyalty or support of the people. Furthermore, the report said, sending troops would mean mobilizing reserves, increasing the military budget. There would be more U.S. casualties, more taxes. And this growing disaffection, accompanied, as it certainly will be, by increased defiance of the draft and growing unrest in the cities because of the belief that we are neglecting domestic problems, runs great risks of provoking a domestic crisis of unprecedented proportions. The growing unrest in the cities must have been a reference to the black uprisings that had taken place in 1967, and showed the link, whether blacks deliberately made it or not, between the war abroad and poverty at home. The evidence from the Pentagon Papers is clear that Johnson's decision in the spring of 1968 to turn down Westmoreland's request to slow down for the first time the escalation of the war, to diminish the bombing, to go to the conference table, was influenced to a great extent by the actions Americans had taken in demonstrating their opposition to the war. When Nixon took office, he too tried to persuade the public that protests would not affect him, but he almost went berserk when one lone pacifist picketed the White House. The frenzy of Nixon's actions against dissidents, plans for burglaries, wiretapping, mail openings, suggests the importance of the anti-war movement in the minds of national leaders. One sign that the ideas of the anti-war movement had taken hold in the American public was that juries became more reluctant to convict anti-war protesters, and local judges, too, were treating them differently. In Washington by 1971, judges were dismissing charges against demonstrators in cases where 2 years before they almost certainly would have been sent to jail. The anti-war groups who had raided draft boards, the Baltimore Four, the Catonsville Nine, the Milwaukee 14, the Boston Five, and more, were receiving lighter sentences for the same crimes. The last group of draft board raiders, the Camden 28, were priests, nuns, and laypeople who raided a draft board in Camden, New Jersey in August 1971. It was essentially what the Baltimore Four had done 4 years earlier, when all were convicted and Phil Berrigan got 6 years in prison. But in this instance, the Camden defendants were acquitted by the jury on all counts. When the verdict was in, one of the jurors, a 53-year-old black taxi driver from Atlantic City named Samuel Braithwaite, who had spent 11 years in the Army, left a letter for the defendants. "To you, the clerical physicians with your God-given talents, I say, well done. Well done for trying to heal the sick, irresponsible men, men who were chosen by the people to govern and lead them. These men who failed the people, by raining death and destruction on a hapless country. You went out to do your part while your brothers remained in their ivory towers watching. And hopefully, someday in the near future, peace and harmony may reign to people of all nations." That was in May of 1973. The American troops were leaving Vietnam. C.L. Sulzberger, the New York Times correspondent, a man close to the government, wrote, "The U.S. emerges as the big loser, and history books must admit this. We lost the war in the Mississippi Valley, not the Mekong Valley. Successive American governments were never able to muster the necessary mass support at home." In fact, the United States had lost the war in both the Mekong Valley and the Mississippi Valley. It was the first clear defeat to the global American empire formed after World War II. It was administered by revolutionary peasants abroad and by an astonishing movement of protest at home. Back on September 26, 1969, President Richard Nixon, noting the growing anti-war activity all over the country, announced that under no circumstance will I be affected whatever by it. But 9 years later, in his memoirs, he admitted that the anti-war movement caused him to drop plans for an intensification of the war. "Although publicly I continued to ignore the raging anti-war controversy, I knew, however, that after all the protests and the moratorium, American public opinion would be seriously divided by any military escalation of the war." It was a rare presidential admission of the power of public protest. From a long-range viewpoint, something perhaps even more important had happened. The rebellion at home was spreading beyond the issue of war in Vietnam. Chapter 19. Surprises. Helen Keller had said in 1911, "We vote. What does that mean?" And Emma Goldman around the same time, "Our modern fetish is universal suffrage." After 1920, women were voting as men did, and their subordinate condition had hardly changed. Right after women got the vote, the measure of their social progress can be seen in an advice column written by Dorothy Dix that appeared in newspapers all over the country. "The woman should not merely be a domestic drudge," she said. "A man's wife is the show window where he exhibits the measure of his achievement. The biggest deals are put across over luncheon tables. We meet at dinner the people who can push our fortunes. The woman who cultivates a circle of worthwhile people, who belongs to clubs, who makes herself interesting and agreeable, is a help to her husband. Robert and Helen Lind, studying Muncie, Indiana, Middletown, in the late 20s, noted the importance of good looks and dress in the assessment of women. Also, they found that when men spoke frankly among themselves, they were likely to speak of women as creatures purer and morally better than men, but as relatively impractical, emotional, unstable, given to prejudice, easily hurt, and largely incapable of facing facts or doing hard thinking. A writer in early 1930, Boosting the Beauty Business, started off a magazine article with the sentence, "The average American woman has 16 square feet of skin." He went on to say that there were 40,000 beauty shops in the country and that $2 billion was spent each year on cosmetics for women. But this was insufficient. American women are not yet spending even one-fifth of the amount necessary to improve their appearance. He then gave an itemized list of the annual beauty needs of every woman: 12 hot oil treatments, 52 facials, 26 eyebrow plucks, etc. It seems that women have best been able to make their first escape from the prison of wifeliness, motherhood, femininity, housework, beautification, isolation, when their services have been desperately needed, whether in industry or in war or in social movements. Each time, practicality pulled the woman out of her prison in a kind of work parole program. The attempt was made to push her back once the need was over, and this led to women's struggle for change. World War II had brought more women than ever before out of the home into work. By 1960, 36% of all women 16 and older, 23 million women, worked for paid wages. But although 43% of women with school-aged children worked, there were nursery schools for only 2%. The rest had to work things out themselves. Women were 50% of the voters, but even by 1967, they held 4% of the state legislative seats and 2% of the judgeships. The median income of the working woman was about one-third that of the man, and attitudes towards women did not seem to have changed much since the 20s. "There is no overt anti-feminism in our society in 1964, wrote feminist and sociologist Alice Rossi. "Not because sex equality has been achieved, but because there is practically no feminist spark left among American women." In the civil rights movement of the 60s, the signs of a collective stirring began to appear. Women took the place they customarily took in social movements, in the front lines, as privates, not generals. In the office of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in Atlanta, a Spelman College student named Ruby Doris Smith, who had been jailed during the sit-ins, expressed her anger at the way women were relegated to the routine office work, and she was joined in her protest by two white women in SNCC, Sandra Hayden and Mary King. The men in SNCC listened to them respectfully, read the position paper they had put together asserting their rights, but did not do very much. Ella Baker, a veteran fighter from Harlem, now organizing in the South, knew the pattern. "I knew from the beginning that as a woman, an older woman in a group of ministers who are accustomed to having women largely as supporters, there was no place for me to have come into a leadership role." Nevertheless, women played a crucial role in those early dangerous years of organizing in the South, and were looked on with admiration. Many of these were older women like Ella Baker and Amelia Boynton in Selma, Alabama, and Mama Dolly in Albany, Georgia. Younger women, Gloria Richardson in Maryland, Annell Ponder in Mississippi, were not only active, but leaders. Women of all ages demonstrated, went to jail. Mrs. Fannie Lou Hamer, a sharecropper in Ruleville, Mississippi, became legendary as organizer and speaker. She sang hymns, she walked picket lines with her familiar limp, As a child, she contracted polio. She roused people to excitement at mass meetings. "I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired." Around the same time, white, middle-class professional women were beginning to speak up. A pioneering early book, strong and influential, was Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique. Just what was the problem that has no